That information turns into intelligence. That intelligence can lead to investigations, and those investigations can result in disruptions of attacks before they occur.
Welcome to this month's edition of the FBI National Academy Associates Leadership APB podcast series. My name is John Kennedy, and I'm the Director of Education and Training for the FBI National Academy Associates. I'll be your moderator today. The Leadership APB podcast series engages law enforcement and public safety executives in the discussions on timely and current topics affecting first responders around the world. These leaders will share with you their leadership and managerial philosophies, successes, and obstacles they have encountered in their careers. The podcast series are free audio programs distributed to FBI National Academy Associates members, staffs, and other law enforcement executives that provide our communities, states, countries, and profession with the highest degree of law enforcement professionalism and expertise. It's a pleasure to introduce and have with us today FBI Section Chief Stephen J. Jensen. Mr. Jensen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Absolutely. And first, I want to thank you for having me here today, one, to talk to the National Academy Associates. I'd also like to say I have a personal vested interest in that two of my family members are graduates of the National Academy, one from 1979 and one from 1983. And I come from a line of law enforcement officers in New York, Suffolk County in particular. And I still have my brother and a cousin, active duty patrolman in Suffolk County. I myself was a police officer. I graduated from the Colorado Springs Police Academy in 2001. I served out there until 2006 when I entered on duty with the FBI. And upon graduating the academy from the FBI, I was assigned to the New York field office. I worked at headquarters. I was assigned as a supervisor to the Chicago field office, and then as an ASAC, or assistant special agent in charge, of the Jackson, Mississippi field office. And then recently, as of May of this year, I was assigned as the section chief over the domestic terrorism operations section at FBI headquarters and oversee all domestic terrorism operations for the FBI.
Well, you're certainly well connected to the NA family. Thank you for your service. This spring marked 25 years since the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City by domestic violent extremists. How has the domestic terrorism threat changed since that time?
It's a really great question. I think a lot of people would assume the domestic terrorism landscape, or the threat from domestic terrorists, has all the appearance of increasing since 25 years ago with Oklahoma City, especially in 2019, which marks the deadliest year since the Oklahoma City bombing. And what I would proffer is that while the incident rate appears to be increasing, just in the number of attacks and the number of lone offenders that we see, it's really the evolving, or the evolution, of that threat. And what I mean by that is many of the same motivations used by domestic violent extremists haven't changed. So the same reasons behind the Oklahoma City bombing, the same motivations for previous bombings by anarchist extremists or other groups, remain largely the same today. And their motivations will probably continue into the future. What we have seen is the evolution of those individuals moving away from in-person group meetings or motivation by like-minded individuals in the physical world into the digital arena. And when it comes to both domestic and international terrorism, lone offenders who act without complex operational planning, using easily accessible weapons against private, civilian, or soft targets, pose the greatest threat. And that's what we saw in 2019 largely, and that's what we've seen with homegrown violent extremist groups who are inspired by foreign terrorist organizations. They're not acting in concert with a larger organization or a network. They're motivated to violence and inspired by specific ideologies, and they take action against soft targets. They become unpredictable in nature. They're very hard to detect before they take action, and pose the greatest threat to local law enforcement and federal law enforcement. One of the other problems with these lone actors is as they carry out these attacks, they're increasingly deemed martyrs. In other words, people of like-minded ideologies ascribe to the same principles or the threat patterns that these subjects undertook, and they're idolized for their attacks. This is further complicated by their ability to live stream their attack and gain notoriety on the internet. As these martyrs gain attention and notoriety through their actions, they become a globalized threat, and that globalized threat, their status as a martyr, serves to further radicalize vulnerable individuals, no longer constrained by boundaries within a continent, but they're able to reach a global audience, and it becomes a broader or international problem that we have to face together. That's where our Joint Terrorism Task Forces, which were initially established in the 1980s to combat domestic terrorism, really come to play in combating this growing threat or this evolving threat. Joint Terrorism Task Forces began in the 1980s, and in the 1990s, only a handful, a dozen or so, existed. Post 9/11, more than 200 JTTFs exist today, and they're critical in the FBI's ability to combat terrorism and meet this global threat.
Mr. Jensen, can you expand a little bit more on some of the factors that have contributed to the evolution of terrorism threats on both the international and domestic fronts?
Yes, and I alluded to this before in the previous answer, but as I said, many of the grievances or motivations used by domestic violent extremists remain the same. They remain unchanged. And these perceptions of these individuals in that the government has overreached their authorities, that one race is superior to another, or that one race has been oppressed by another or by the government, remain just as effective as a radicalizing factor back then as they do today. The difference in today's world is, again, the readily availability of the information through the internet. And it's not so much that the internet has become a vector for radicalization. It's a tool that's used by individuals to propagate widely their ideology. And we've seen this emerge as the internet and social media increase the accessibility of both homegrown and domestic violent extremist ideologies. The problem with this is that an anonymous user sitting in a basement or in front of a computer can write messages on a message board, in a public chat group, or in a private messaging room and reach a global audience. And it's widely available to anybody with an internet access or who's invited into these private chat rooms. And it becomes a vector for radicalization that we have no access to as law enforcement or have limited access to if not made aware by the public or family members who become aware of the radicalization process. We're also in law enforcement and in the FBI in particular, seeing subjects of violent ideology move to encrypted application platforms, which again makes it more difficult for law enforcement to identify and disrupt violent individuals prior to them carrying out an attack. And this is even when we have lawful warrants or lawful access through other processes.
This is an incredibly complex situation and issue. So how can the FBI stay ahead of the curve when international and domestic violent extremists have developed such an extensive presence on the internet and through social media?
So I think the FBI has a strong history of adapting to emerging and complex threats. We've seen this happen all through the history of the FBI, but in particular, combating gangsters in the 1930s as they evolved in interstate commerce to carry out their crimes, frustrating state and local authorities from the ability to actively disrupt their activities. In the 1970s and 80s, combating La Cosa Nostra with international access and broad-based, wide-ranging racketeering activities, and countering the sophisticated criminal street gangs and drug trafficking organizations that emerged in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s. All of these threats were addressed with some creativity, moving sophisticated techniques of investigative strategies, but the one common theme was working very closely with state and local partners, creating task forces to identify, disrupt, and dismantle these criminal organizations was the fundamental principle of how we execute on an enterprise theory of investigation. And it's no different in the international terrorism or the domestic terrorism arena. And again, I'll harken back to the creation of the Joint Terrorism Task Forces in the 1980s. Very innovative strategy to combating a unique and evolving threat of domestic terrorism, which was ramped up in large scale post 9/11. The collaboration from state, local, and federal law enforcement and the successes of the JTTF just underscores the value of those relationships. Many of the plots that have been thwarted in recent years would never have occurred without our partnerships of state and locals on those JTTFs. And that's not just state and local law enforcement. That's other members of the intel community, other members of military or law enforcement apparatus, and it includes foreign partners that contribute intelligence and actionable information. And those collaborative efforts are really the key to staying ahead of the curve as a threat evolves. One of the other things that we focused on post 9/11 and continued to ramp up in the 2000s and through today with the emergence of technology and social media is creating and relying on strategic partnerships within the private sector. These strategic partnerships maybe existed in small nodes previously, but as a large organization, developing relationships at all levels with strategic partners, with private sector organizations, private companies, and social media companies, developing a working atmosphere where they're comfortable sharing information directly with the FBI and law enforcement to alert us to radicalized individuals and hopefully disrupt any plots or actions before they manifest into an attack. And just as an example of that, in August of this year, a subject was sentenced to over 2 years in prison for sharing information online about creating explosives. His online messages included offers to teach other social media users how to make explosive devices, and his intent was to take out cell towers and news stations directly attacking infrastructure within the United States. The FBI was alerted by one of our strategic private sector partners, which passed the information to the JTTF, who immediately took action to disrupt and prevent the attack from being carried forward.
In follow-up to that question, Mr. Jensen, can you share with our listeners what does the FBI know and or have learned about domestic violence extremists, specifically Antifa and Boogaloo?
Within the previous months, I know the United States, largely the whole world, has been watching what's been unfolding across many cities in the United States. And in the very short period of time, the idea of domestic terrorism threats emerging in the United States has become a common theme both in media and in politics. What we know or have learned about domestic violent extremists largely confirmed a lot of the activity that we've previously seen, and I mentioned in previous answers, which is many of the motivations towards violence remains the same. I think what we have seen recently on the streets in the United States is many people seizing an opportunity to vent their frustrations or express their ideologies because of opportunity, whether it's perceived overreach of the government because of coronavirus restrictions and shutdowns, general disdain for government operations, which you would see in anarchist extremist ideology, or competing ideologies on the streets during a protest, looking for opportunities to engage others of an opposing ideology. What I do need to say and stress is that the FBI doesn't investigate. We don't open cases on individuals merely for an association with a group, membership in a group, or based solely on ideology. The FBI does focus and predicate investigations based on violent offenses committed or intended to further a violent ideology. And I think that's a key distinction regarding FBI investigations in the domestic terrorism arena. Specifically regarding Antifa and Boogaloo, it's equally important to understand what these terms mean and how we view those terms. Anarchist violent extremists tend to lack an overarching national structure. And by nature of being an anarchist, they disagree with formalized structure of government or organization. But as we've seen recently, they have the ability to quickly mobilize in reaction to issues or events that conflict with their ideology. Some violent anarchist extremists are known to self-identify or associate with the term Antifa, which I'll call a movement. Antifa is a movement within an anarchist extremist ideology and stands for anti-fascism. It can be used by both nonviolent adherents of this movement as well as violent extremists using it as a reason or justification for their violent activities. Boogaloo is similarly not a defined group, although some individuals may join together claiming to be a Boogaloo group. But the Boogaloo is merely a concept to reference a second civil war or the impending insurgency against the government. It may be used to describe a large-scale violent conflict or a race war, anticipating the collapse of the system. And the system in this case is typically used to reference the current form of government in the United States. The FBI has seen the concept utilized by various adherents of mixed domestic violent extremist ideologies. So not just militia extremists, which we'll talk about in a little bit, or racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists. And they can use the term boogaloo in reference to a civil war, which has very different meanings based on their ideology. And while I can't comment on any ongoing court cases that may reference these concepts, I do want to reiterate that our concern and the FBI's focus is always to prevent violence before it occurs or violations of federal crime in order to protect our communities.
Since the FBI domestic terrorism program does not investigate membership in groups or ideology, can you expand a little bit on how domestic terrorism threats are categorized and your focus on violence versus group membership?
Yes, and as I said in the previous answer, we don't predicate investigations solely based on group membership or based solely on ideology. And I am going to state what the FBI does and does very well is focus on violent offenders who intend to carry out criminal acts in violation of federal criminal law in furtherance of their ideology. The categorization of cases or investigative files is a way to keep things organized, to conduct trend analysis, and it's a way for our brains as investigators to help put structure to things that might otherwise be structureless. For the purpose of trend analysis, I think it's important for us to identify broad-based categories that much of the ideology fits within. And a majority of the FBI's cases fall into one of the four following categories. The first, which represents the single greatest threat posed by domestic terrorist extremists or domestic violent extremists, is racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists. In this category, you have those that believe one race is superior to another and are willing to carry out acts of violence in furtherance of that ideology. And conversely, you have those who will carry out acts of violence because they feel their race or ethnicity has been oppressed by others, to include the government. The second category is anti-government, anti-authority violent extremism. And within this category, we typically see traditional anarchist extremists, some of which we've already talked about with Antifa leanings, as well as militia extremists who tend to be opposed to the government. The third category is abortion extremism. This category includes both pro-life and pro-choice violent extremists. The fourth category is animal or environmental rights extremism. And those are fairly self-explanatory and include individuals who are willing to carry out both crimes of violence against people as well as significant crimes against property or animals. And we have a broad-based bucket or categorization that we titled domestic terrorism other, and it's somewhat of a catch-all where there is ideology or there's mixed ideology. No one ideology is necessarily more prevalent than the other. These individuals are equally dangerous, no less violent, but they tend to be of a mixed ideological background. In other words, they're ingesting numerous ideologies in furtherance of their violent tendencies or their criminal behavior that they intend to carry out. I'm also well aware, based on the previous question about Antifa and Boogaloo, that the current social climate is probably at the priority of most people listening today. The FBI has worked closely with state, local, and federal law enforcement partners to focus our investigative efforts and resources on instances of violence, damage to federal property, and violations of federal law under the appropriate statutes to, one, positively identify those subjects and where ideology exists, identify their networks, and proactively move to arrest and disrupt any further attacks that are under planning. And as I've said before, we focus on violent acts and violations of federal criminal law that are affecting our communities.
While we understand that you can't comment on ongoing cases, but can you share with our members and listeners the domestic terrorism program's arrest successes and maybe some statistics in the last few years and year-to-date with our listeners?
Absolutely. And the FBI's domestic terrorism program has great successes, not only over the last year, but the last previous years. I mentioned that in 2019, it poses as the deadliest year for domestic terrorist attacks in the United States outside of the Oklahoma City bombing, which we already referenced was 25 years ago. Before I get into any specifics about arrest statistics or specific case examples where I'm able to talk about them, I do want to highlight again, none of our successes would have been possible without the JTTFs. The ability of the JTTFs to leverage both state, local and federal resources, as well as the ability to proactively investigate and charge, whether it's on state charges or federal charges, individuals who are motivated to violence based on ideology is without question. And underscoring that or underpinning that is the idea that and the knowledge that more than 50% of FBI cases in domestic terrorism originated from either public tips passed to state and local partners that fed into the JTTF apparatus or came directly from state and local partners in order to disrupt violent offenders motivated by ideology. Now, that being said, the statistics for the domestic terrorism program in the FBI are robust. Over the past several years, more than 200 terrorism subjects have been arrested each year by the FBI. Specifically, when it comes to domestic terrorism arrests, in fiscal year 2019, the FBI logged 107 domestic terrorism arrests and 121 international terrorism arrests. For fiscal year 20, the FBI domestic terrorism program already has 115 arrests on the books. And that's without including specific arrests related to the civil unrest that we've seen playing out since May 28th this year. For specific case highlights, again, it's important to note these case highlights are part and parcel with the JTTF and the local partnerships that we have. The reason these cases are being highlighted is their impact in preventing violence by a violent, ideologically motivated person. And while the name is not going to be shared, some might be familiar with the case or might be aware of it because of specific details that are present in the public arena, whether it's in the media or through other outlets. But recently, a Baltimore man was sentenced this year to 13 years in prison. The significance of this sentence is that the underlying charges that he faced for weapons violations were enhanced by a terrorism statute or a terrorism enhancement statute that was levied against him because he used or advocated for focused violence in order to establish a white homeland. This is one of the first times that a terrorism charge was used in a domestic terrorism case. This subject specifically purchased equipment in preparation to take action to establish the white homeland. And the Baltimore JTTF was able to move quickly and charge him with firearms violations as a means of disrupting his activity and preventing a crime of violence from occurring, after which they were able to apply that terrorism enhancement at sentencing that I talked about. Without that terrorism enhancement and the work of the local JTTF, the subject would have faced a much smaller sentence upon conviction for firearms violations. The second case is in Oklahoma City, and it's appropriate not only because of the impact and the crime that it prevented, but also marks on the 25th year anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. This subject was recently sentenced to 25 years in prison for attempting to use a weapon of mass destruction in his goal of replicating the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. This subject held an anti-government extremist ideology and was motivated to target an Oklahoma City bank with what he described as a replication of the notorious bombing in 1995. The JTTF in Oklahoma City was able to prevent another act of domestic terrorism in a community that has already experienced the impact of such an attack.
Well, we have one more question for you then, Mr. Jansen. How can the public assist the FBI and law enforcement with your mission?
So if there was one call to action or one takeaway for those listening, I'll bring it back to the post 9/11, if you see something, say something. The ability of the public to provide information to state and local law enforcement so that it can be actioned immediately with the goal of preventing future terrorist attacks can't be underscored. The importance of that is without question. And I'll go back to the data point I provided previously in that more than 50% of FBI investigations related to domestic terrorism originate from public tips shared with local law enforcement or directly from local law enforcement. Specifically to our local law enforcement partners is to continue with the JTTFs. Those partnerships, I hope, are mutually beneficial. I've seen the benefit of both on both sides, and I would continue active and proactive engagement with JTTFs, participating in the executive boards, participating in the meetings for awareness, and assigning investigators to be a part of preventing violence. What I would encourage local law enforcement to do is to proactively share information with the FBI. There's no provision of law that requires local law enforcement to provide information related to domestic violent extremists or ideology. Unlike other classifications of law like hate crimes or color of law violations that have a requirement for direct reporting to the FBI, domestic terrorism does not have that requirement in federal law, but it's no less important. And I would strongly encourage those listening today to establish relationships if they don't have them, or enhance those relationships for information sharing when a patrolman stops a sovereign citizen to directly share that information with the FBI. When they come across ideology, even if it's not in violation of a criminal statute, to share that information with the FBI where it was lawfully obtained. That information turns into intelligence. That intelligence can lead to investigations, and those investigations can result in disruptions of attacks before they occur. And for the general public, going back to if you see something, say something, because of the ability of individuals to radicalize online, to do it in the dark of a room where nobody can see, families, friends, and those close to individuals are going to notice changes in behavior or patterns that indicate they're on the path of radicalization. The sooner they report that to us, the better we're going to be able to provide strategies to prevent them from radicalizing to the point that they take criminal action and hurt others. And with that, I would like to say that it was truly an honor to be able to speak to this audience today. I can't stress enough that our success relies on the sharing of information with the public and our state and local partners. We certainly consider the FBI National Academy Associates as one of our greatest assets, and I thank you for sharing this platform with me today.
Section Chief Jensen, it's been a pleasure to be able to talk to you today. Again, thank you for taking the time to share your expertise with our FBI National Academy Associates members, staffs, and our other law enforcement colleagues. This concludes our broadcast. We hope that you'll be able to join us again next month for the next edition of the Leadership APB podcast series. Please stay safe and well. Goodbye for now.